everyone. Welcome to the Animation Pimpcast. My name is Chris Robinson. I don't know what number this one is. I'm in Montreal. It's cold, but you'll hear this months from now, so you don't care what the weather is. And what hotel are we in?
The Hotel Argua.
Argua. Okay. I don't know what that means. My guest today is a Canadian animator, Bruce Elcock.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome.
Thank you.
So how was your experience here this week?
It was amazing. Yeah, it was on the jury, the Sommet du Cinéma d'Animation, and it was a super nicely programmed festival. Small, but really a pleasure to watch the films. On the jury with Sarah Vandenboom from Paris and Michel Bouchard from Saguenay. And it was nice. We all had different things that we liked, but the overlap made sense, and we were able to speak together without really fighting. So that's always nicer. I'm really happy with the results.
And this is another jury that went with the supposedly controversial film Hippopotami.
That's right. We all liked it very much. It's a strong film, but yeah, like you were saying earlier, it's perhaps more controversial than is warranted.
Yeah.
But beautiful to look at.
It seems, I mean, from what I've heard, I mean, it were people outraged in Annecy.
Huh.
People, I don't know, maybe two. So, and then somebody in Ottawa during the Best of the Festival screening at the end, somebody started booing the film and just they had their own opinion and apparently wouldn't
Fair
listen
enough.
To any other opinions.
There's always one or two like that. Yeah. But I was kind of happy to see a film that was pushing a few buttons.
I mean, it got people talking. Yeah. So you don't see that too often these days.
That's for sure.
So what have you been doing these days? The Global Mechanic, and you did something. Was it in the spring? It got released
with NFE. Yeah, it was 54 hours. I was director for hire and co-directed with a guy named Pete and Francis, and it was a film about called 54 Hours about the seal hunt disaster of 1914. Big story for any Newfoundlander. We all grew up with it, and there was a book about it in the 70s called Death on the Ice. And this was a retelling 50 years after that retelling, written by Michael Crummy. And it was based on transcriptions of the interviews and Cassie Brown's interviews. She was the novelist that made the one in the 70s. And we told it with archival footage, archival photographs, and shadow puppets. So and a lot of compositing, weather effects, and texture stuff. But it was the material's so concrete, we went pretty emotional and abstract with it. And it was a pleasure to work on.
It didn't get sent to festivals, did it? To animation festivals?
That I'm not sure about. It's had a funny life so far because it was made for the 100th anniversary of the event.
Right.
And we premiered it in St. John's, and from there, I think it went around on a little circuit of things like that. I'm pretty sure it played at the Atlantic Festival, but I'm not sure what they're doing with it. Other than that, I think it's one of the few things I've worked on where I can look at it afterward and go, I think that's good. Usually, you know, your baby is ugly and you have a hard time looking at it. So I'm not sure what's happening with it. Yeah. The premiere was kind of great. There were all sorts of very old people that came who had strong family connections to it. Pretty much anybody's a handshake away from the event
right.
in Newfoundland, but... you know, these old ladies, I remember my father coming back from, you know, it was great. It's pretty moving.
Were you approached to get involved with this or did you initiate? Or?
Yep. Annette Clark from the Atlantic office approached me and she had the storyboards in hand from Peyton and she wasn't sure where to go with it because the design was a little bit, cartoony. It didn't quite have the gravity that the subject needed, so she asked my opinion and I sent it back and she asked me if I'd be willing to co-direct it. Well, I'd like to talk to the fellow first and see, because you know that can go two ways. Peyton was amazing, really easy to work with and hardworking, and it just, there was a good affinity.
Was that the first time you co-directed?
The first time I co-directed a you know an art project.
Yeah. And that was a good experience.
It was. Yeah. It was nice to back and forth, and you know, you get used to imposing your will, and it was. I think it was healthy to push it around a little bit.
Right.
Yeah. It was fun too. I mean, he's a pretty easy guy to get along with, which helps, but also he's got strong family connections to the story and already knew it through and through. Like any image that we'd make, he'd say, oh, that's this specific object or person, and this is their story, which I didn't know the detail. So it was, that was part of it, to figure out how much detail to keep in and how much to, you know, turn into metaphor.
And you were from Newfoundland.
That's right.
Originally.
Yep.
Yeah. So even though you're on the other side of the country now.
Yep. If I'm Vancouver, doing the split.
Keep coming back. And you did a film, I've forgotten the name.
Vive la Rose?
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. That one we shot in Bay Bulls, just south of St. John's. And that's absolutely, I've got this project for my life, ideally, to represent Newfoundland and what it is to me and who I am to it and all of that. You know, it's that dealing with Newfoundland and dealing with music is really pretty much central to what I like to make.
Why is there such did you pinpoint your strong connection to Newfoundland? I mean, a lot of people, I guess, from there have that connection, but a lot of people don't necessarily have that connection to their own homes.
That's true, huh? That's, I don't know. I mean, it's a pretty powerful culture. I don't know. I've always felt like there's some kind of spiritual presence to the landscape itself that draws me back. All my family's there. It's bred in the bone. I think it's an unusual and special place, but I'm biased.
Right.
So yeah, but the sounds, you know, the love of music and being social, all of that stuff is who I am. So I don't feel like I can divide myself from it.
Do you go back every year?
Oh yeah. Yep. Yeah. I've got a house in St. John's and, so we'll go back there for, between 1 and 3 months, generally a year. Yeah. Ideally more down the road.
How did you end up in Vancouver?
So far
away.
Yeah. I didn't know Vancouver at all when I moved there, but at the time I was with Anne-Marie Fleming.
Right.
And she and I moved there from Chicago.
Chicago.
Yeah.
Right.
I was there for 5 years with Tricky Pictures. So yeah, initially it was love, and then that love went away and another one came, and that's why I'm there now.
Right.
Yeah.
And what are you working on now, and how's the studio?
The studio's doing great. We're doing, as always, a real mixed bag of stuff. The last couple of years, we hired a guy named Karis O'Connell, who's was a former UX guy from Nokia. So we're moving into information architecture, user experience, that kind of stuff. So really exercising a different part of the brain. I'm liking it a lot. Then we're continuing to do commercials and TV series and things like that here and there. We just got boards from the government of Colorado looking to, it's basically, it's legal now, so we need to talk about safety. Don't drive while you're under the influence. So that was a fun one again. But
wow.
Continuing on to other, you know, there's some art projects. We're working with the Art of Time Ensemble out of Toronto on a piece called I Send You This Cadmium Red that is going to show at, I think, UCLA this year. They just remounted it this last year. It's theater, music, and projections, all about letters exchanged between John Berger and John Christie, the painter. So I did design the set and did the projected animated painting while they're talking. It's a pretty cool show.
Do you do you consider yourself like a boutique studio?
Yeah.
Do you decide, okay, there's got to be at least one independent project a year, or?
I think it's a little more organic than that. It generally plays out approximately that way, 1 to 2, sometimes 3 at once. But yeah, I mean, it's in the DNA of the place to make independent work alongside commercial work.
And You're very particular about what you take on, too?
So it depends on the time. Sometimes you can't be particular. You say, oh, you would like something done? Yes, we will do it.
The bank account's low. Then.
Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I've always, ever since the very beginning with Cup of Coffee back in 91, I've always tried to put out work that's not straight up commercial, not like everything else. And it tends to engender that same kind of work. So I haven't had to be too... I haven't had to push away a lot of work because often the right kind of work comes, but you know, there's a big variation. I was doing Mattel commercials for a while, right, and that we don't really show, but there's bread and butter along with the other stuff.
Is it harder to make a buck now than it was?
It is. Well, 2008, the economic downturn was pretty exaggerated, and the Americans came to Canada a lot less than they did before. And after about 3 years and things started coming back, it was about the same time as big broadcasters were splintering. So it's kind of a perfect storm. So now commercials in Canada are about 10 times less lucrative than they were. And in America, about 5 times less. So it's a bit dire. So in some ways, it's been a nice change because... it turns out that some of the independent projects are funded comparably to commercials. So it's no really? Longer just getting commercials in order to pay to make independent work. It's, you know, both are viable. Doesn't mean I'll stop doing commercials because I actually really like doing them. They're a concentrated short burst and you have to be pretty disciplined and, you know, at their best, they're creatively really satisfying.
Does the like right now the Canadian dollar's low? Does that tends to
help?
See more?
Yeah. We've gotten more boards from the States in the last little bit.
Right. A few years ago, you did like an interactive thing for like iPad or something.
Yeah.
Can
we
you
did.
Tell me about that.
Sure, we did. Right. Let's see. The first thing we did was an ASCII, like a retro ASCII style video game called Sir Bit, and I made all the music for it. It was kind of 8-bit blues, which was a lot of fun to make. And then we did a kids' book called A Sweet Story with John O'Howard, who's a great animation writer, and it was a semi-interactive kids' book. And then what else? We got some Canadian Media Fund funding to do a wine tasting app. So that's been really good. It's in its third year now. So we've gotten past development and we're into really getting it out in the market. But
how does a wine tasting app work?
I know. The idea was to make a more intuitive and visual sort of accompaniment to an orthodox wine tasting. I mean, typically aesthetics of wine tend toward, you know, Moroccan leather and burgundy and brass. So I wanted to design something that would be bright and colorful and have a lot of white space in it, kind of like 60s super graphic stuff.
Right.
Typographically too in that neighborhood. So I made up this idea of a 5-petaled flower. Each of the petals corresponds to part of the wine tasting. Eye, nose, mouth, duration, and overall opinion. So what you do is with your finger, you shape each petal up and down for a score and left and right for qualitative stuff. So it can be maybe you look at the wine and it looks beautiful to you, so you give it a high score, but it looks really transparent, so it's a thin flower. Or it's really intensely colored, so it's a fat flower. So you begin to... over time, see the petals and be able to understand, oh, okay, that's the kind of wine that I'm looking at. Anyway, you go through and you shape sliders and move stuff around, and it's just sort of a very happy-looking, simple path, but that brings with it all the background data that you need to have a sort of professional-grade wine tasting.
It must be quite a different, approach when you're dealing with interactive stuff.
For sure, yeah, it's... I mean, when you're making narrative work or even experimental work, you're thinking about how people are going to take it in. The cognate for me with interactive is people are
taking it in and relating to it, but the way that you guide people to relate to what they're interacting with is like narrative, and that if the visual hierarchy is clear, then it's self-evident what to do. It's strange though, because interactivity is more conservative in some ways in creating narrative, in that what people call intuitive is really familiar. If it's familiar, then you feel like you know what you're doing. If it's unfamiliar, it pushes against you a little bit. So you're always riding this balance between what people expect and teaching them something or taking them a little farther. And if you push it too far, it just breaks down. But as an animator who likes thinking structurally, it's satisfying to do interactive work, because ultimately, any work that you do, you start with breaking it down to what are you trying to do and why are you trying to do it and who's going to use it and what do they want to get out of it. So it becomes a super formal exercise that can then create something delightful. So yeah, different from narrative for sure. But
and how did the story, the Sweet Tooth project, come along?
Geez, I'm trying to remember. That's a few years ago now, yeah. but we were talking with John O. Howard and with John Eisen, who was working in Sudbury at the time and since moved back to the Yamroll guy, who since moved back to Vancouver. And we were talking about figuring out some way to work together. I think we had a project coming up with WGBH that we wanted to talk with John about. And we just got together and we were talking with him about these ideas for books that we'd had, because we're working on a couple others, and he wanted to partner with us to make Sweet Story. So, and we got along great, so made it easy.
What kind of funding would you get for that?
That one we self-funded. Yeah.
So you rely on sales from...
Yeah, we hoped to rely on sales. As it happens, interactive books have turned out not to really make money, because ultimately the experience is poorer than a game, so it's kind of a bad game, and it's poorer than a book because it's not as satisfying in a lot of ways as reading a regular book. So you end up with children reading it in order to find the Easter eggs they can interact with and ignoring the narrative.
Right.
Or if you don't put enough Easter eggs in, then they're not interested in playing with it. So, yeah.
And even getting people to find your app must be...
Oh, yeah. Well, now that there's a billion or... Yeah, it's crazy. And Sweet, if you look for a Sweet Story, you will find it. If you look for Sweet Story, won't show up because there's too many similar things. So, yeah, naming becomes a block. And it's very much like making short film. Nobody sees them.
That's true.
Yeah. Sadly.
Yeah. And so you're working on some more?
Yeah. Yep. We've got a very old friend of ours from Tina's of mine from Chicago named Marco Markovich is a really amazing artist. He's been working on one called Bear and Bee. I was writing it and we're sort of collaborating on it, but it's a story about bees and bears and how much they like honey. It's a preschool one. But the kind of Eastern European looking.
I see potential for this story I've always had called Bumblebee Man. I used to tell the kids I used to be a superhero named Bumblebee Man. And I have an old Boston Bruins shirt that just has a bee on it, and it's nice. Black and gold. So they started to wonder, maybe Dad's telling the truth.
That's good. Yeah, that moment of, really? Is a fun one.
Because I had an enemy, the bear. It was one of the... I lived in the hive.
That's good.
Anyway. What's the size of Global Mechanic?
We're about a core of about a dozen people, yeah. And then we hub and spoke depending on what we're working on. So we've been as many as 50 and as few as a dozen. And right now it's funny the way studios have changed over, you know, the last whatever it is, 25 years or something, making stuff. In the beginning, it was a giant art working space and a considerable shooting space, man, maybe a computer, and now it's pretty much all computers. Right. We don't even have a flat file cabinet full of nice paper anymore. Which kind of drives me crazy because I love the physical.
Right. Hmm. Well, how old is the studio now?
At least 14 years. We started in 2000. Wow. Yeah. Came all of a sudden.
And how many people started at the beginning?
At the beginning it was Anne-Marie and me. Yeah. So, yeah. What is that? Two.
Wow. Do you ever hope to leave and go back to Newfoundland?
Yeah. I mean, our idea down the road is to live part time in Newfoundland and part time in Paris.
Okay.
So we'll see.
Why Paris? Why not?
Yeah, exactly. We both like it a lot there. I was an au pair there years and years ago, so I know the city pretty well, and we both speak French. And
you were an au pair?
I was. I ironed children and folded.
How did you get to talk about that?
Well, yeah, how did that happen? All right, so I did a music degree in the tuba at U of T, and then I traveled around for a year. And then I wanted to continue in academia because I felt like I didn't learn how to read or write doing a music degree. And I chose Comp Lit. They said in the program, you've got to read and write in another language to be able to do it, but the language courses don't count. So I thought, okay, I'll go somewhere and live and learn the language, and ended up in Paris doing that, and then went back into the Comp Lit program.
Okay, and you were the au pair?
The au pair. I looked after... The first family was the ex-wife of Jacques Chirac's doctor, and she had four children. The 17-year-old girl did not want me in the house. The 16-year-old boy...
How old were you at the time?
I was 22.
Right.
Yeah, 16-year-old boy couldn't believe his luck that there'd be a man around, and then the two little ones were just sort of, oh, okay, this person will read to me, I'm happy. And I had to cook for them in Paris at 22. It's a bit intimidating, but wow. Learned some good recipes. And
how long did you do this?
A year.
Really?
Yeah, took language courses and traveled around a lot.
You would live with the family?
The first family, they had an apartment off-site, but yeah.
And that would be, what were your hours?
I had the mornings to take language courses, and the afternoon through to the end of supper, I'd have to take care of the kids or cook or, do whatever needed doing. Clean.
Wow.
Iron people's underwear. Yeah. It was a good way to learn French. It's a good way to see the city, because the pay was next to nothing, but you got a bus pass and, 22 or... Yeah.
I'm amazed that a 22-year-old guy could cook and iron underpants.
So were the French. Any French people I met said, a man who can iron? It's impossible. Yeah. So anyway.
Oh. Was animation on the horizon for you at all then?
Let's see. When I was a kid, there was an NFB office in Corner Brook, which is where I grew up, right, on the west coast in Newfoundland. And my friends and I would go in there and watch 16mm prints of everything. And if they didn't have it in the office, which was often the case, they'd order it down from Montreal. It was amazing. So after a while, we could operate the projector. And then after another while, we bought a projector and would have our own showings and stuff. And we took a couple of classes and... I was really into it and into drawing, but more, it wasn't just drawn animation. It was pixelation. It was, Norman McLaren ripoffs and Ko Hodeman ripoffs. And we were just trying to imitate whatever we saw.
Right.
But I was better at music. So I went into music, and my friend went into fine art. And, years later, after the Comp Lit degree, I was in Barcelona, went to a life drawing class, started to draw seriously for the first time. And then met Dirk van de Vondel, who's a Belgian animator who was living there at the time, and apprenticed under him for a year. And then came back to Canada, went to Sheridan College for about a month and a half, and then got some gigs working for Much Music, and that's what launched Cup of Coffee.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry, long roundabout answer, but...
thinking of when kids graduate today, I always have it in my head that it's probably easier for them in animation today than, say, 20, 30 years ago, where it felt like the choice was you're going to be the starving artist or you're going to go and be a cog in the machine of a studio. It seemed to be an either-or thing,
mm-hmm.
where it strikes me that with technology and whatnot, that that's not the case now. It's not an either-or. You can kind of do both if you want. Like,
yeah, it's true.
You've sort of shown.
Yep. And it's a funny time, though, because programs at colleges, at a lot of colleges, seem to me to be much more focused on career and less on just learning and general preparation. But you're right. It's an easier time to mix what you're doing. Still, it's surprising to me the number of people that want to end up in a big studio, doing Saturday morning stuff.
Yeah. And Emily Carr seems to have changed quite a bit.
Uh-huh, too. For sure.
Went from being more artsy, lack of a better word, to maybe focusing more on the commercial side a bit.
And the schools like VFS out there are in Vancouver Film School are really right on the getting students prepared to get a job in X. I mean, I've always thought, education path, ideally you learn a lot of things and then you find what you're going to do. But, that worked out for me. It's not for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, there can be a danger, too, to just nurturing everybody for this one path. And
for sure. If you're monofocused, you don't tend to think that broadly about what you're doing. So, in some cases that's handy. Like if you're a doctor.
Right.
But, a bricklayer.
A proctologist. Mm. Do you people you hire and stuff, are they mostly coming from Vancouver area, from schools? Or
we've got a lot of, we've sort of got a United Nations going right now. We've got people from all over the world. So it varies. Just depends on who comes in the door. I mean, when people move to Vancouver for a little while or a long while, they tend to find the studio because there aren't a lot of people doing what we do there. And we tend to attract polyglot people who'll do a bunch of different kinds of things. Hire a fair number from local too. It's just a real mixed bag.
Right. I want to go back and talk, and we've talked about it before, but just for the sake of people, the six people listening, talk about At the Quinty Hotel, which is one of my favorite films of all time.
Oh, that's very nice of you.
Just to talk about the whole evolution of this film and how it came about.
All right. When I was at U of T doing music, Al Purdy, the poet who wrote At the Quinty Hotel, was a writer in residence, and I saw him read a bunch of times with my old friend Alex. And he had this incredible voice and delivery that was hilarious and great and powerful. And I heard him read that poem and the Margaret Atwood ones, a bunch of other ones. Just sort of let that sit and percolate in the background for a few years. When I came back from Barcelona, I had left because I thought I could stay another year and continue learning with Dirk and be really adept at his style, or come back and do my own thing. So I was trying to figure out what that would be and how to go about it. Sheridan College was a place to go, but also I was coming up with boards for my own ideas, and I thought of Alex, who had brought me to see Al Purdy first, suggested that poem in particular. I thought that would be great. And I started working on boards for it, contacted Al Purdy. We went to his house and recorded him, which didn't go very well. He wasn't too happy with a couple of skinny, smart-ass college boys coming to his house. But we talked to his wife for a long time and got some good information. And I continued working on the boards and applied to the Canada Council and got the grant right around the time when we were just starting Cup of Coffee and just getting the Work With Much Music. And that started to take an awful lot of time. So I got the grant. I can't remember what it was for, like $4,000 or $6,000. And I went through the recording and did all the gang sync stuff. So I was sort of ready to start, did a bunch of test drawings, and then it lay fallow for 12 years.
Yeah.
I kept meaning to get to it, to get to it, and just couldn't. I think I was turning it into the sacred cow and not attacking it. But in some ways that was good, because I was developing the craft the whole time and thinking about it in the background and where to go with it, working a lot with sound and timing, to the point where when I finally could get back to it, it was when I was back in Vancouver, after leaving Chicago, and I wanted to make sure that even though I'd had all this time and these were ideas of a much younger person, I wanted to keep the freshness of the initial conception of the technical approach, and stay pretty rough. So some of the animation is done with willow charcoal and drawn really quickly and roughly, that I think fits the material really well. I used an awful lot of kind of dirt and crap that was lying around the studio to make sure that it was texturally strong. And I wanted to impose a clear structure in terms of color, but without making it too self-conscious or certainly pretty, because it's not appropriate to the poem. Right. I don't know.
What was it about the poem originally that really captured your interest?
Well, I mean, initially it was his reading, his voice, what he brought to it for that. I read about him a lot and read about other poets' relationships to him. I've had a long interest in poetry. It was this the opposite of precious, kind of rough approach to life. I'm saying rough too much, but, you know, there's a reality and a grit
Canadian Bukowski.
I think Bukowski had a nice quote about Al Purdy, that Canadian guy, he's pretty good, something like that. But yeah, I liked his anti-prettiness, and it really came down to that and the rhythm.
And the recording you used, was that one from your visit? Or?
No, the one from the visit didn't work out. We brought in Niagara and everything, but he just wasn't willing to.
Did you just show up at his door, or did you arrange?
We had arranged it. We wrote a letter and then had a phone call, and then when we came, he was off. He didn't want to talk to us too much, and I don't know how seriously he was taking it, and he went to the pharmacy partway through, and we were talking, and we didn't see him again. I said, my wife will give you chili. And that was it. We sat down and ate with her. And we had brought him a bottle of whiskey. And she said at the end, thanks for the liquor, boys. It's a strange experience. But
he went to the pharmacy and then he came back.
And then we went to see the Quinty Hotel. And it's a strip bar. And apparently it had gone through an iteration as Maid Marian's. It was a Robin Hood themed strip club. So it looked like a good place to get beat up, which is, you know, about right.
I went to stay there with Kelly a few years ago because of the film, but we might not have, because it might have been too expensive. But
in Trenton,
right? Yeah.
The recording was from, I can't remember if it's 64 or 65, but it was the first Congress of Canadian Poets. So Michael Ondaatje was there, and Irving Layton, and a bunch of other of luminaries. So it was kind of an important recording.
Did his widow see the film?
She did, and she liked it very much.
Yeah.
Yep, there's an A-frame trust now that's continued on, that's sort of named after their place. That was an A-frame, working on generating interest and money for his foundation. They've saved his outhouse where he used to, the poets that visited him would have to go out and they had to write something on the walls inside. So it's an important relic of Canadian poetry.
Where did he live?
He lived in Ameliasburg, Ontario, in Sydney, BC.
Where's Ameliasburg?
It's just outside Trenton. It's a little tiny place. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah. How do you think waiting that long to complete the film turned out to be?
I think
for the best.
I think it was for the best,
as opposed to the young skinny guy doing it.
Or? Yeah, he would have messed it up. I don't know. It would have been a different film, but I know I was certainly a much more mature animator by the time I got to it, and I think that's part of what allowed me to keep it as loose as it was in the end. Which I think it needed sort of off the cuff messiness because that's what he delivers too. But yeah. You know, it's just like poetry. There's this unbelievable labor for a thing that plays out very quickly because it's small.
You seem to like working with like mixed techniques. Is it just don't have the attention to focus on one, or you like
that
mix?
That might be it. yeah, I don't
Which
know.
Is also something like technology has made possible. You couldn't have really, I mean, I guess you could mix live action and puppet or something, but
it's true. It was harder before.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know. I think a lot of it comes out of looking at all those NFE films when I was a kid, that I thought every technique is animation. Yeah, I think I go naturally toward that because of that background. Certainly there's a bit of a dabbling mentality too, where I like to try all sorts of different things. And, I don't know. I think part of it comes out of, from reading underground comics too, that there are approaches to, There's hugely divergent aesthetic approaches, but also to narrative, there are so many different ways to represent people that it feels right to use a few of them at once. I was looking at some Mobius comics recently, and there's the Inkle, and there's the John Dufool character who looks completely different depending on what part of the story that you're in. I've always thought that just makes sense. You look different when you're mad or sick or you know, your heart is broken. So does the world. I think there's a transformative aspect to reality that is well suited to multiple techniques. I think that's why.
What were some of the other animation that influenced you, like outside of the NFB?
Let's see. The New York guys.
Denoyer, and, yeah, of course. That makes sense. Paul and Mino? Mino?
Yeah. They're swapping photographs, and there's one with where there's a woman covered in mud sitting on a couch, and they take Polaroids of her and stick them up in front of the camera. Right. By the end, they've all developed, and the mud has dried and cracked. Right. And you can see her diaphragm moving up and down very quickly because she's breathing normally, but because of the speed of clicking off the frames. Yeah, I liked their kind of discipline. And Shell White and his stuff I really like. Yeah. Certainly Svankmajer and the Norstein and Norm McLaren, of course, but, you know, aside from NFV... and those ones stick out particularly. Yeah.
Do you have, there's that increasing trend now, it seems, with independent animators to want to make feature films.
Mm.
Is that something that appeals to you?
I'd like to. I think I've been trying to figure out the right project for a long time because, you know, feature films... Shorts, you can be experimental, you can be very dense and concentrated, you can push things on the audience that they wouldn't accept if it was much longer than a short film. Features by nature need to be somewhat conservative because people are so used to the kind of story structure that's put in front of them with features. And they watch so many of them. Right. They have an expectation of it. And in terms of budget to make something animated that's that long, like with TV series, you need to systematize to a certain extent. And I tend to buck against systematization. So that those are the main things that have held me back from going there. But I'm a giant film fan. I watch stuff all the time. So I definitely want to do it. It's a matter of which project. And there's a lot to be said for people like Wes Anderson and Michel Gondry who super stylize what they do. That I find really appealing, and I think there are more places to go with it. Michel Gondry, of course, using live action for the most of the film, and then turning to a little throwaway moment that's animated and often in a super homespun kind of arts and crafts crappy way. Right. That is a perfect realization of that kind of method. I think there's a lot to be said for taking key emotional moments and going in a completely different world. You know, even like Kill Bill does it.
Right.
Yeah. But
do you think the Canadian landscape could? Can you fund an animation?
Jeez, I sure hope so. I mean,
it seems like everybody's running to like the crowdfunding.
There's a lot of that out there, and there's a big gulf between the live action and animation worlds, and taking one another seriously. And I think making an animated feature for adults, I think, would be great, but it's a hard sell for a lot of people. It's got to be the right project. There are two or three sort of on the slate right now that I'm thinking about. I can't talk about, but yeah.
Right. I mean, they'd have to be co-productions too, I'd imagine.
I imagine, yeah. Depending, I mean, it's possible to do something really cheaply. I had an idea for one with shot entirely with a GoPro camera strapped to the face of the actor, so the whole thing would be a single close-up. But right. That you wouldn't have to spend much money to do, right. But I'm not sure if people would want to watch it either.
Sounds like a Hal Hartley concept.
Yeah, yeah, hmm. Yeah. I'm starting a workshop tomorrow with the NFV in Vancouver and Newfoundland on a piece about chronic pain that's half an hour and mostly live action. So I'm interested to see where that goes and where it leads as far as possible feature. Down the road.
So when you say workshop, what do you mean?
Well, it's development. Just so we're meeting and talking and right. brainstorming okay. about it. We've gotten a start on boards, and the writing is pretty much there. So, just figuring out what form it'll eventually hopefully take.
Now, how is music still a big part of your
life? For sure. Yeah, I had stopped playing for about 20 years because deciding to leave music was a big and tough decision.
What were you playing?
The tuba.
Yeah. Just the tuba.
The tuba.
You can't play anything else?
Yeah, I can mess around on other stuff, but the tuba's it. And part of why I left the music degree really was in the end there wasn't a lot of music written for it.
A tuba
yeah.
player?
Yeah, anything before like the late 1800s, there's no music unless it's transcriptions, and jazz even is limited. So I don't know. I had a lot of other interests.
Parades.
Parades. Always the parades. There's the A&W. I left it. And then a friend asked me to come and sub in a band, a 45-piece like concert band in Vancouver. And it was a really nice awakening. And then I started jamming with these East Vancouver hippies who'd say, "Oh, tuba, man, it's an awesome texture," and they'd play all kinds of different instruments. So it was fun, and it was liberating because we didn't read any music; we just jammed. So compared to classical training. It was, yeah, completely different world and a great pleasure. Yeah. And then I started playing with a brass quintet, and that's who I'm playing with now. I've often said it, felt like opening up a room to, like doors to a room that had been long abandoned. It was amazingly powerful to reawaken these memories of practicing forever when I was a kid and, performing, and just the feeling of the communion of conversation while you're making music. Yeah.
Didn't George Pell, didn't he make a film about a tuba player?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I'll have to look.
Years ago. Timmy the Tuba or something.
And Cordell Barker puts one in all his films, I think, or at least most of them.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. He's got a new one coming out. So.
Yeah. Looking forward to that.
Listen for the tuba.
I stayed for the tuba.
when you're just about people's reactions to animation, like, you know, when I sometimes get caught thinking that about the general public, that they don't take it serious, they just think it's animation's just this laugh riot thing, mm-hmm. you know, it's just for kids. But then there's the other side, like the art world, and you've done projects that have crossed over.
Yep.
Do you find that they also don't take animation too seriously?
Yeah.
Sort of looked down upon a little bit.
Yeah, and I think even in the film world, like live action people, they're the guys who were always working much later than us, but doing a bunch of stuff I don't care about.
Why do you think there's that?
I don't know. I can't figure it out. I mean, there's in certain circles, obviously it's taken seriously. I find here in Quebec, the audience tends to be more conversant in it or aware of its connections to its artistic merit, I guess. I mean, certainly the world of commercial cartoons is powerful and has done a lot to define what people think of as animation. Right. So there's that great weight. I can't count the number of commercial jobs that we do where people say, oh, I thought animation was just cartoons every time. But
it's strange. I mean, if you take music, for example, there's a lot of crap hollow music out there.
Yeah, you're
so
right.
So much of it, but you wouldn't say that music doesn't get taken seriously because there are other.
Yeah, I wonder. Huh? I mean, does it have to do with how hard it is to see it?
I mean, I guess that's part of it.
Yeah,
at least. I mean, for the public, yeah.
Yeah,
they just don't know.
Exactly, you
know, it's not on TV.
Yeah,
it's hard to find, but the art world, it's still.
Yeah, the art world, I don't know. I mean,
resistant to, unless you're William Kentridge. Or.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why people like William Kentridge and Robert Breer haven't, enabled people to see more in animation. Or Norm MacLaren, there have been so many.
Right.
You know, it's a mystery to me. Boy, what do you think?
I don't know. That's why I asked you the question. Yeah. It's like I really don't get it. I get it on the public side that they're just not exposed to it. But
I remember, you know, everybody talks about those vignettes that were on CBC TV in the 70s. And I think it needs some cultural institution like that pushing it out there. I was hopeful that YouTube and the like would popularize it more because... you know, people's quirky personal interests tend to come to the surface more in that than they have in the past. But even that, some things get seen, but yeah, geez, I wish I knew. 'Cause you know, obviously I care a great deal about it and think it's valid in pretty much every way, as I know you do, but yeah. Wah.
Yeah.
It's a bit like classical music in that in some ways you need education about it for it to be present.
I think I've resigned myself over the years that it's just, especially with festivals too, that we're just not going to reach a huge amount of the local public. I mean, Ottawa's done much better over the years, but it's never going to have the appeal of.
And it's funny too, because I've got friends who live in Ottawa who come to the festival when I come to the festival. I don't know if they go other than that.
Yeah.
But every time they've gone, they've enjoyed it immensely and talked about it a lot. And the images stick in their heads and the ways of thinking stick in their heads because they're, you know, unusual.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, it's because it's the Cassandra story. You talk about it and nobody believes you.
No, I think it's, I don't know, animation. Maybe it's a bit like poetry. It's just got this niche. It's a little...
Yeah,
group, and it's just always the way it's going to be. Maybe it's not so bad.
I hope not. Yeah, well, that's true. It's a nice cool group community, of people. So. Yeah.
You wouldn't want it to get too crowded.
That's true. Maybe. Yeah.
All right, Bruce, thank you for your time.
A pleasure. Always nice to talk.
We look forward to more work.
Coming soon.
To a... Video to screen, everything iPad,
yeah.
Everywhere, TV screen. All right, thanks.
For sure.